Welcome to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability. Your hosts are Bill Reed and John Becker, co-authors of the Integrative Design Guide to Green Building. This program will help you take sustainability to the next level. Here are your hosts, Bill Reed and John Becker.
Good morning or afternoon, everybody. This is Bill Reed
and John Becker
with Building Deeper Green. And today we are exploring and expanding our exploration, I should say, of green building with understanding the systems of food and leading, of course, to the systems of life, which is what we're sustaining.
So we have
John, go on.
Yep, so our program today is simply entitled How Sustainable is Our Food? And our purpose is to explore the connections between buildings and food when we are looking at the whole.
So one of the ways that, one of the reasons that we've decided to talk about this issue is that it comes back to the basics of sustainability.
Yeah, so Bill, how would you say food is connected to buildings and our built environment?
Well, you know, it may not be apparent or directly apparent, but if we are talking about sustaining life, then of course it's required. That activity, life, requires nutrients. And without food then, without a healthy source of food for all life, there's no such thing as a sustainable condition. So it's at the technical, elemental level. If we don't have good and healthy food, not only for humans, but for all species to support the web of life, we actually cannot have a sustainable system.
Okay, so what's wrong with how we've developed our patterns here in the U.S., where we've got cities? And then we've got huge industrial farmland where there aren't cities. What's wrong with that pattern?
Well, I think I might even want to start. Let me just go a little more basic than that. And oh, that's pretty basic. But one of the issues that has impacted me in thinking about these about sustainability is that buildings, of course, are a major impact on the planet, and they serve as our shelter. So our shelter, the needs of humans are actually impacting the planet. When humans require shelter, humans also require nutrients. And it's interesting that our buildings are a major influence, and it's interesting that our agricultural systems are the other major influence, and in fact, in this case, negative influence on the planet.
Maybe bigger, eh?
Well, certainly they're related because it requires food to live in buildings, and communities, by their very nature, were formed around food, sustaining food, hunting, and certainly then agricultural systems.
Okay, so what are the primary impacts that agriculture, farming, has in its current practices environmentally?
Okay. Well, certainly it uses a tremendous amount of water. And John, you have an interesting statistic on that I never remember.
Oh yeah, it's really phenomenal. The largest underground aquifer on the planet apparently is the Ogallala Aquifer. It extends from, you know, like I guess South Dakota all the way down to the panhandle of Texas, 190,000 square miles. Now, what I've read is that we didn't start throwing water out of the Ogallala until the 1920s. Currently, there is a well for every square mile. There are 190,000 wells drawing water out of the Ogallala almost entirely for agricultural irrigation because, of course, that's the breadbasket of America. And the studies that I've read, I've actually read three of them, that based on the current consumption, and of course, we're not recharging the Ogallala because we're building all of these buildings and roads and impervious surfaces and then conveying the water elsewhere rather than allowing it to infiltrate. So the combination of the lack of infiltration and recharge and extraction will lead to the depletion of the Ogallala in less than 50 years. And this is water that's literally millions of years old and if left alone would take nature about 6,000 years to replenish.
So water is one aspect of unsustainability. So if we aren't replenishing, if we can't do it forever, it's not sustainable, and we certainly aren't doing that with
actually, it's
water.
Worse than that, right, Bill? Because,
right, sure.
Yeah, it's not only just the water we are using is now being polluted.
Well, so the farming practice. So what we do with our farms is we have now, we no longer talk about cycles. We've talked about water cycles, the ocean evaporating in the rain and falling on the earth and the earth cleaning the rain and then we drink it. What we're doing with the food cycle is that we are drawing food nutrients out of the ground, eating it, and then the waste, our fecal matter and urine is actually the fertilizer for fields, replenishes the soil that's been removed. Vegetables don't come from nothing. They come from a combination of molecules of soil, water, and air. And so when we don't put those soil molecules back, we're actually depleting the soil. So what was once the breadbasket of the world with 40 or 50 feet of some of the richest soil on the planet is now down in places to inches of poorly soil with basically no nutrients that requires fossil fuel nitrogen fertilizers to replenish it, which is not as effective. And now the USDA reports that our vegetables and food pulled out of these artificially fertilized fields are at 35% to 45% less nutritive value.
Well, and Bill, what's interesting is to put this into a context of like this is nothing new. I mean, Mesopotamia, currently around the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, was in fact referred to in our history classes when we were kids as the Fertile Crescent, right? In other words, the depletion of nutrients in the soil generally results from concentrated human developments, yes?
Right. And also an improper use of water. And that gets to the whole erosion issue, because the faster we let water move through a landscape, it rips soil out. And you know, the basic question is, why is the Mississippi River brown? It's not because it's supposed to be. It's because we have poor soil and agricultural practices. And that, in turn, sends the over-nutrified soil, nitrogen, and sediments down to the Mississippi River, into the Gulf of Mexico, creating what is remarkably large, and the size of Connecticut, apparently, last time I heard, dead zone where no aerobic life exists.
Okay, so there are the problems. That's why we're talking about this. What maybe I think I'd like to try and focus us on is, okay, given all the discussions we've had about consciousness and humans participation in the health of the place and our role in nature as a healing organism potentially, is to engage a discussion, okay, what can we do differently? So in order to do that, I'd like to introduce our guest today, Ben Haggard from Regenesis. And Ben, are you there?
I'm here.
Well, welcome. Ben, what is it that you do?
Well, it's changed over the years. I spent many years doing permaculture, really, permaculture design and developing theory, designing landscapes that were modeled after natural systems but produced the needs for human beings and helped restore ecosystems while basically being agricultural systems. More recently, I've become much more interested in how do you develop community will to manage things like agriculture and manage nutrient flows, manage energy flows, so that they're beneficial for communities and the planet.
Well, that leads me actually to two questions that are actually quite different but clearly connected, and that is, you said community will, but you also touched upon a notion about the nutrient cycle. So maybe to get to community will, we need to talk about, for a moment, what do you mean by the nutrient cycle?
Okay. The living systems are basically the engine for living systems. The first building block is solar energy that's being converted into sugars by plants through chlorophyll. So that's the starting point. The solar energy drives life on the planet. But then life is continuously taking that sort of starting supply of sugars and translating it, transforming, and then cycling it through the systems that we're all part of. And so animals eat plants, plants and animals die, decay, microorganisms and fungi break down the nutrients, transform them again, cycle them into a form that they can be picked up again by the next generation of plants and animals and so on. And we're part of that. We are animals in that overall system, continually exchanging nutrients with it. One of the issues with the way we've designed our agricultural systems and the way we have kind of dumbed ourselves down with regard to them is we've lost track of that constant flow and exchange of nutrients and how critical it is for the for the places where we live as well as for the planet as a whole.
So if we can hold the community will off for just another moment, I'd like to ask the question again. So what's the problem with the pattern of building our cities and separating them from these large agricultural lands that we use to farm and feed ourselves?
And you want a simple answer, right?
You can answer that any way you think best.
So they're kind of there are multiple levels to that question. On one level, by creating agriculture, highly simplified agricultures, we've taken very complex, layered, and productive natural systems and reduced them to the kind of lowest level of plant production or animal production. So generally, what we as human beings prefer in our agricultural systems is annual crops. And annual crops in natural systems are primarily, they're the weeds, they're the pioneers that come in and allow the system to sort of scab over, get stabilized so that it can grow something more interesting and more productive, like a forest or a prairie. So that's one of the issues.
Over a longer period of time, you mean?
Over a longer period of time, but the productivity of a highly, if you think about it, I love this example. A single valley oak tree in California was able to support an entire Native American family for a year.
What was that area again?
A single tree, a California oak tree,
wow.
Valley oak, could support an entire family of local Native people for a year.
Right. That's staggering.
Exactly.
Well, and that gets...
Go ahead.
Just the idea of, I want to actually come back to the idea of what permaculture means, Ben, and maybe this is a good example to kind of convey that, is that I don't want to put words in your mouth, but my understanding of permaculture, it stands for really, it's in a derivation of permanent agriculture, and that in order for a culture to exist, it has to understand the source of its food.
Right.
And so that example of an oak tree and what it does, it's both shelter and it probably offers dead branches for fire fuel. It's almost a system in and of itself.
Right.
And by the way, the fire contributes to the nutrients that feed back the roots of the tree, et cetera.
Sure. Exactly. Yeah, and so it is a system in itself, but it also is part of the system and requires a living system that included human beings tending it to maintain its health and vigor and productivity. Yeah. So now I'm afraid I've lost where I was going with that, but I guess my real point is that a tree, like an oak tree, can take a very small amount of surface area on the planet and through the vast surface area of its leaves translate that into an enormously productive engine for food, right? And that productivity is much, much higher than if you'd taken the same amount of space being occupied by that tree and turned it into annual grain crop, for example.
Okay, well, then you are getting back to the question of the city versus the large industrial farmland in a way that I don't quite understand yet. That's why I'd like to go there. But we need to take a break here. And if you could hold that thought, we'll come back and ask that question again.
Great.
Are you a wildfire survivor? Do you need help but don't know where to turn? SoCalHelp.org is a place you can go to get immediate help with food, shelter, important medications, and start getting your life back on track. Get help now with insurance, legal issues, and find professional help like doctors and counselors. You can also connect with other survivors and people who can help. For the answers and support you need to rebuild, visit SoCalHelp.org.
Many designers are adapting their design process. They are developing methods to address the environmental impact of their work. Graphic, industrial, interior, architectural, landscape, identity, and fashion designers share a common experience. By revealing the thought processes of people from a wide range of design disciplines, your understanding of sustainable design strategies will deepen. Join us every Saturday at 1 p.m. Eastern Time, 10 a.m. Pacific, for Design Evolution on the Green Talk Network.
America is facing a skilled workforce shortage. SkillsUSA can help. What is SkillsUSA?
SkillsUSA is life-changing.
SkillsUSA is awesome.
SkillsUSA is one of the biggest opportunities life can give you.
SkillsUSA is amazing.
SkillsUSA is motivating.
SkillsUSA specifically prepares you for the workforce.
SkillsUSA empowers students to connect with a network of people, starting with their classmates, to their advisors, to other people in their states. SkillsUSA allows students to connect with business and industry, to manage their education, and to really get a feel of the real world. I'm doing something now that's going to be applicable in the real world, and those skills are going to be useful today in school and in 5 years when I'm working and for the rest of my life.
SkillsUSA champions at work.
On the web at skillsusa.org.
At the Green Talk Network, our experts want to hear your voice. Do you have a question or comment for our hosts? Call us toll-free, 1-888-346-9141. That's 1-888-346-9141. The Green Talk Network. Spread the green.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, everyone. We're here with our guest, Ben Haggard from Regenesis. And Ben, you were talking about this phenomenally staggering idea that one oak tree could support an entire Native American family for a year, and using that as a bridge to explain the problem with our current development patterns related to our agricultural patterns. So,
by the way, let me just interject on the idea of oak acorns themselves. They are an incredibly, using a lot of superlatives here, but they are an amazingly nutritive food that can support life ounce for ounce much more powerfully and sustainably, if you will, for a longer period of time than other food types.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, mostly where you get the highest concentration of human beings and the development of cultures and civilizations around the world was in the oak zone. It's a particular kind of latitude and environment that oaks thrived in, and human beings, to a certain extent, co-evolved with them. So oaks are a great example. I guess my point is that an oak forest, I was trying to illustrate what it means to have a higher level of productivity from a living natural system than from an imposed agricultural system, because that becomes sort of the starting point for the thinking that permaculture evolved out of, which is, can we design and develop agricultural systems that are as layered, complex, resilient, and productive as natural systems. So modeling our agricultural systems after natural systems.
So that's one of the key areas of your exploration with the work that you do, is that right?
Yeah, that was kind of where it all started. And there are a whole bunch of things that can come out of that. One is the idea of these very complex layered polycultural assemblages of plants and animals working together like a natural system. And there are indigenous examples around the world that that permaculture derived from, and then permaculture extended and began to design new ones for applications in all kinds of settings, rural, urban, aquatic, and so on. So it's like the first building piece is the idea of radically extending the productivity of our agricultural systems by making them as complex as natural systems.
Well, I just want to interject on that. The idea of it's not only a nutrient system, it's a whole feedback system, that the closer we are and the more engaged we are with food, the less likely we are to draw the principle out of the planet, like the Ogallala Aquifer, and live on its interest. because we're in direct relationship to it, as opposed to thinking of it as this unending resource that I can go to the grocery store and pick up off the shelf at will.
Yeah.
Well, that reminds me of something that I think we talked about or mentioned, is that when, for example, in certain places like a small town in Italy, I sit and I eat food and drink wine in a place where I can actually look out over the landscape and see where that food was harvested, grown, tended, nurtured, and the wine was made, it's transformative for me. And Ben asked me a question when we were talking about this, well, how is it transformative? And I realized that the way it is for me is that it makes me feel like I belong to that place more, in fact, love it more, because I then am inextricably one of the components of that nutrient exchange. Flows from that place through this organism, back out through this organism, right back into that place and that nutrient cycle.
Yeah, that's exactly it. That we talk about things like this as though they were sort of ineffable. You know, the quality of place and the experience that you're describing, but literally, the place is in when you're living there and eating from it, it is creating your body.
And you, in turn, are creating the place.
And you, in turn, are creating the place.
Actually,
the exchange is literal and material, as well as energetic and emotional and cultural and so on.
So, Ben, can you give us an example of a place that you've worked that has emerged from a place that wasn't quite healthy when you found it to a place that was evolving in a healthy way?
Uh-huh. Well, I've worked in a number of places, but it's easiest for me to talk about Santa Fe, my hometown. And Santa Fe has a history of desertification, basically, the going back most intensely during the last 150 years, when Santa Fe, which was a small colonial outpost, reconnected to Mexico and to the United States, to the East Coast, it became a kind of trading crossroads. And during that period, railroads were brought in, vast numbers of grazing livestock were introduced, there were mining. Lots of mining was beginning to happen. And so during that time, the landscape that was here was radically degraded. And so the kind of desert landscape that people come here and appreciate and enjoy, because it is very beautiful, is actually a landscape that was created by inappropriate human intervention.
And all within, you said, the last 150 years?
Last 150 years.
Really, primarily after the Industrial Revolution.
Yeah, oh yeah. One of the things that we do in any site that we're working on or any community that we're working with is to try and trace back and understand what are the ecological dynamics that were present here that allowed a healthy, resilient, and stable ecosystem and human system to endure here for thousands of years.
A story of place.
Yeah, exactly. And how did that get disrupted by this historical phenomenon? And what in the culture is trying, often in the culture of any place, there are certain themes and strands that you can discover that that are trying to reestablish that earlier resilient balance.
And can you give me an example from Santa Fe?
Well, in Santa Fe's case, I think that the fact that we are a kind of a crossroads, we're a very powerful cultural crossroads. It's this weird phenomenon. We're a very small town, 65,000 people approximately, and yet we're the third largest art market in the United States.
I've always found that amazing, actually.
So that is an indicator of something extraordinary going on here that has to do with the beauty of the place, its attractiveness to artists, its attractiveness to people who want to experience culture, and so on. So that's a very good example of the kind of theme that we'd be looking for that will allow us to understand how this community could begin to heal its relationship to its place.
So this connects us back to the will of the community.
Yes, exactly.
Okay, can you go there a little bit?
Sorry?
Can you?
Yeah, well, let me see if I can complete the circularity of my thinking.
Okay.
So one of the things that food that is grown in this particular landscape, our water source is snowmelt from the southern tip of the Rocky Mountain chain. And so we are a snowmelt supplied agricultural system. We have very poor agricultural soils, and where we do have agricultural soils, it's in little narrow mountain valleys, basically, tucked around in the landscape. So those were rich oases, you know, in a dry, difficult, harsh environment, fed by snowmelt, okay, with high elevation, very intense sun. All of those things taken together, little pockets of soil, tight-knit agricultural villages, the intensity of the sun, the purity of the air, and all of those things give the food here a very distinctive quality.
So almost like the terroir in a wine, you can taste the place.
It is terroir is exactly the word I use to describe it.
Okay.
Right. The flavors are distinctive, the qualities of the produce is distinctive, the qualities of the wine and so on, and the medicinal plants, all of that have a distinctive place-based quality that arise from this distinctive spot on the planet.
And I might add the quality of the light that creates the art market, or that might create the art market.
Precisely. So one of the things that we begin to look at is if what you want to do is to foster the small agricultural local producers, then what you need to do is tap into the artisanal nature of this place, right?
What nature?
Santa Fe has actually the most flourish. Santa Fe has an extraordinarily successful farmers market, certainly the strongest one in the state and one of the strongest ones in the country, because there's a strong artisanal quality in terms of the chef and restaurant community here.
And what do you mean by how would you define artisanal?
Well, it has to do with growing, as a farmer, it has to do with growing into your crops, with how you care for them, those qualities that give them terroir, you know, make the flavors distinctive. In other words, you're moving in the opposite direction of commoditization.
Got it.
And I just want to interject here as a thought that terroir is much different. It's more of a whole of an issue than it is what we in the way that we commonly think about quality farming. And the term of art these days is local and organic.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, this is going well beyond that.
I just wanted to point out that difference. In fact, there's just a fun example that Bill Mollison uses in the Permaculture Designer's Manual where he shows a factory egg versus an egg that was grown locally. And if you just change the factory farming process by removing some chemicals, you've got an organic egg, but it fundamentally doesn't change the industrial nature of that production.
Right. Remember we talked about that in the last show, the 2 pages of all the components that it took to make an egg when all you really need is a chicken next door?
Well, I'm glad you're here to remind me of these things, John. I've got a memory of a day.
That's okay. But where Ben, I think you're headed with us is how, then, can we integrate our communities, in terms of built environment, with our food production in ways that are healthy.
Right. Yeah, and the question of will has to do with, one of the things that really generates community will is being true to oneself as a community. And so we work a lot from what is the unique quality of a community that it has pride in, and then how do you build off of that?
And how do you do that?
Well, in the instance I was just talking about, the artisanal, there is an enormous amount of pride and recognition of the artisanal nature of life in Santa Fe, right? And so if we begin to build an agricultural system off of the idea of an artisanal way of life, then it's actually relevant to this unique place and something that people can recognize themselves in.
All right. That's a good pause point. And we'll continue this conversation in a minute after the break. We'll see you shortly, folks.
What can you tell me about SkillsUSA?
SkillsUSA teaches you employability skills. So you know how to deal with people, you have teamwork, your resume is going to look awesome.
Well, it's important to know your technical skills, but not only that, to have soft skills, the skills of learning how to communicate with people.
On the web at SkillsUSA.org.
Can we recognize our world not as a commodity, but as a sacred creation that will support us best the more creatively we live on it? Green Visions is all about how a spirit of innovation and pleasure can be brought into solving our environmental problems. Join your host, Carolyn North, each week as she talks about what citizens of the world are doing to make a difference. Heal the planet, heal yourself, and have a good time doing it. Tune in to Green Visions with Carolyn North every Wednesday at 1 p.m. Pacific Time, 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Green Talk Network.
Hey, y'all. This is Stephen Cochran. As a country artist, I have traveled around this great country of ours, often meeting our brave men and women in uniform. And as a Marine and veteran of both the Iraq and Afghan conflict, I know how important it is to thank our troops who defend our freedom each and every day. One of the best ways to thank them is to give their children and spouses the gift of education. Scholarships for 2 years, 4 years, and vocational school. This is exactly what a national charity Thanks USA does. Please go to their website, www.thanksusa.org, to make a generous donation to the Thanks USA Scholarship Fund for the families of the troops, and I thank you.
Keep listening to the Green Talk Network for the latest in the sustainability and green movement for all of our futures, today and tomorrow. The Green Talk Network. Spread the green.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, everybody. We're here with our guest, Ben Haggard, talking about the sustainability of our food. And we've been going down what may appear to many to be, maybe slightly ungrounded, although I think we're going to tie that in together because the will of a community is so significant in this work. Let's take another bit of a parallel track and talk about the nature of buildings and people and food and what that relationship may be in the future. What are the trends that are happening? Ben, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah. Again, it's a rich topic, but let me just throw out several ideas and we can build on this. First of all, there's no reason why the built environment can't be food productive.
Well, World War II certainly evidenced that. Most towns fed themselves in their backyards.
Exactly. There's no reason why it can't be extended, particularly if you've got community will in place, so that every community in the country, even small ones, have open spaces dedicated to public use, parks and plazas and river walks and so on. Every one of those spaces is a landscape. It requires investment of maintenance and water and energy and time and so on. And every one of them could be productive.
Well, I just had an aha moment. I get the will thing now because the first thing that came to my mind was the skeptical one. Well, what about all the folks who are going to go there and destroy those food gardens with, walking their dogs through them and littering them, etc.? Well, if the will of the community is there to understand the key connection between that food and their quality of life, then those kinds of things won't happen.
Yeah, but it's interesting that I've never seen anybody do that. When people see food growing, they have an incredible respect for it. We actually have a garden at our house in suburban Boston, And we have a woman across the street, an older woman from Maine who is a farmer, grew up on a farm and actually farmed for decades. And she uses our garden as a she's almost our docent, an unpaid docent. She gives tours of it to the neighboring kids and adults on what growing is like. It's really fun.
You
and
know,
it's actually bringing the community together. So
all
there's
right.
something about
it. You know, that reminds me of something else that is another. I'm just trying to think through what the problems are here. There's this wonderful little garden in an urban growing farm area in downtown Boston, in South Boston, actually. And I was walking through it last year, and it's like all the gardens are in jail. Everybody's got their own little plot of land, maybe no more than, I'd say, 12 by 20 tops.
Is that right?
And there are these huge, I mean, everyone's taken the least expensive things they can find from the trash heap and built these sort of barrier fences so nobody can get in and steal their food.
Mm-hmm.
So, Ben, with the idea of this integration that you're talking about, how can that happen?
Well, I guess from my point of view, it's an all-of-the-above kind of thing we're looking for, right? I talked about how the will of a community needs to be rooted in its unique sense of place and its unique culture and its unique landscape and water and air and so on. And so this is not a the principle fits anywhere, right? There's no reason to not be utilizing our, you know, urban landscapes as productive systems. There's no reason I can see at all. Right? But how that manifests will change from neighborhood to neighborhood and city to city.
Well, there is the reason there, and we have to address this in our part of our design process, is to help people realize that it is not urban growth is not necessarily just turf grass.
Exactly.
And maple trees.
Exactly. And in fact, the sooner we convert turf grass and maple trees, well, maple trees are productive.
Well,
the sooner we translate turf grass into agricultural systems, the better, you know, the better for the community, better for the planet, and the better for, you know, the way we raise our children.
All right. Well, then this raises for me another. I mean, I'm sort of playing the devil's advocate here because this stuff keeps popping up, but. We've seen so much of the degradation of prime farmland, if you will, mainly because its value is much less than prime building real estate. So here you are in a city of prime real estate. How can you afford to let some of it just be for growing food?
Well, first of all, most cities are born are actually located on prime farmland.
Yeah.
Because that's where we tend to settle our cities. Mm-hmm. And when they grow and sprawl, they sprawl into the agricultural areas for the reason that you're saying. So underneath the city is the prime farmland. It's still there.
wonderful.
The city is an amazing concentrator of fertilizer, water, various kinds of energies, including solar radiation and so on.
It's the supply side of the nutrient
labor.
Cycle. It can contribute to the supply side of the nutrient cycle.
Exactly.
Huh.
And instead of having the city be primarily a waste producer, it actually is a supply producer.
Well, and a recycler.
Right. If you create systems and design systems that actually allow that nutrient recycling to occur. And so when you actually look at the cost of dealing with the waste stream, and if you're looking at managing that within the urban environs, the real estate question starts to change. Right?
And it's just an interesting sidelight to the role of buildings in agriculture in certainly revolutionary times in the U.S. and around the world, I know, but there are examples in the Boston area where they built walls and used buildings as heat retainers so they could extend their growing season. And the crops were built right against the buildings to create a longer growing season.
You know, my wife's parents just moved into a new house just outside of Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and they planted these tomato plants in a raised bed right next to a south-facing brick wall because it was the only place they had in the yard, and these plants were like 7 feet tall.
Mm-hmm.
They couldn't understand why they were growing so much, and I posited that it's simply the radiant heat from that brick wall all night long keeping those plants warm.
Sure. It basically, you're taking the built environment, and I'm thinking of all dimensions of the built environment, including physical things like the built walls, but also you know, the heat exchange that goes on with regard to, you know, conditioned spaces and so on, all of that has the potential to be harnessed to support living systems.
Including roofs.
Including roofs. Yeah, I mean, the building itself is potentially a growing space.
You know, Ben, you said something that I want to come back to it because it's really struck me. You said, well, maybe the real estate equation in terms of economics works when you start to take into account perhaps the ability to reduce that which is spent on our waste infrastructure.
Yep.
Say more about that.
Well, that kind of thinking only begins to work when you've got collective will, right?
Mm.
When we begin to think and work more cooperatively as communities, rather than sort of defending the rights of, you know, individual property owners and developers and so on, then you can begin to get a more rational pattern of development, one that's actually more respectful of the landscape as a whole, the well-being of the community as a whole, and so on. This is one of the reasons why we're always arguing for moving beyond thinking about the specific building or the specific site. The specific building or site is the place where it gets manifested, but if you don't set the pattern in place at a larger kind of community or regional scale, then it doesn't work, it doesn't make sense.
And there's the beginning of that. I know Montgomery County, Maryland, where I spent a lot of my professional career, has a pretty active transfer development rights system where the farmers are being supported. You can't develop on those, on that land, but the developer basically pays, if you will, value for the land. The farmer gets to inherit the value of the land, keep the farm, and the developer is given the rights to build higher buildings in an urban area.
So are you guys suggesting that maybe there's some sort of economic and nutrient exchange among landowners that starts to gray the property lines between properties?
Sure.
How would that work?
Oh, dear.
I'm just kidding.
Well, Bill was offering one sort of fairly simple mechanism by which that's accomplished, namely transfer rights.
Yeah.
But all of that needs to be held within the rubric of a kind of regional or bioregional ecological planning process, whereby we understand where are the agricultural soils, right? Where is the most appropriate concentration of human development? What are the upper watersheds that need to be protected for future generations and all of those layers?
And it's very difficult to do that if we approach things from a piecemeal perspective. In fact, you can't do it.
Yeah.
Well, so you have to understand the patterns of soil, geology, groundwater hydrology, geofluvial morphology, all that stuff.
Actually, I don't think so. I don't think it has anything to do with that. What I keep hearing out of this conversation and the arc of these prior conversations is it has everything to do with how we as humans choose to behave.
Right.
And that has everything to do with how we choose to think about how we behave and how we are.
Right.
And hence this back to the will of the community thing, Ben, I think that you hit the key.
And John, though, I think that the will comes from an acknowledgement of a whole.
Understood. And I think that, but I think that we can teach. Oh, well, maybe I'm jumping the gun here, but maybe that's
Go for it. Give it a shot.
We can teach how systems interact. We can teach about mutually beneficial interrelationships, but until that becomes internalized in ways that we understand that we're participants in that system and change our will, we're not going to accomplish anything.
Oh, so you're saying that what you're saying, the data is insufficient?
Yes.
Yeah, well, sure. But you have to start with data to be able to tell the story. Okay. So people have to begin to participate in experiencing the way those flows work.
Fair enough, and that's really where I'd like to go in this conversation is how do we do that? What are some means by which we can practice this that are practical?
Yeah.
I know that's redundant, but...
Well, yeah, got it. Ben, you got some ideas there you want to share?
Well, I'd love to come back to that question, but I want to weave in one earlier theme back into what we're talking about. I talked about moving towards far more layered, productive, polycultural, agricultural ecosystems. And I used the oak tree as an example, right? An oak tree is potentially a street tree. And so when I'm thinking of agricultural systems moving right into the heart of the city, I'm not thinking necessarily of tomato plants or only of tomato plants. I'm thinking of all the layers. Right? And how do we turn the city back into a natural system?
Well, we'll come right back to that. Ben, if you can hold that thought, we'll be right back after a break. Thanks.
Attention swimmers, get out of the water! Everybody, out of the water immediately!
Dude, is that...
It's a pair of thunder thighs. Big ones, too. That mom, who's been swimming a lot with her kids, must have lost them.
Whoa. I heard about this happening once up at Laguna.
Small step number 54. Play with your kids. It's just one of the many small steps you can take to get healthy. Learn more at www.smallstep.gov.
A public service announcement brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Are you thinking green? How do you make your home, family, and life green? Green Today with host Nelson Martinez aims to answer these questions and more. Look to the show as your guide to everything green, from the global movement to what's going on in your neighborhood. We can all do a little something to help our local environments and the planet as a whole by being smarter consumers and using products that are less harmful. Listen for Green Today with Nelson Martinez, Mondays at noon Eastern, 9 a.m. Pacific, on the Green Talk Network.
In the great scheme of things, a minute isn't all that much, unless you happen to have a stroke. All of a sudden, those minutes count, minutes that could mean losing your ability to talk, move, or walk, which is why, if you can get help in time, your stroke can be treated. The warning signs of a stroke include sudden numbness or weakness of the face. If you experience this, call 911 immediately. Visit strokeassociation.org or call 1-888-4-STROKE today. A public service announcement from the American Stroke Association and the Ad Council.
Thank you for listening to the Green Talk Network. Help to spread the green by involving your family and friends. You're doing your part. Now help them think green. Spread the green. The Green Talk Network.
You are listening to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. If you have a question or comment about today's show, please send an email to Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. That's Shannon at RegenesisGroup.com. Now, back to our program.
Welcome back, everyone. We're talking today with our guest, Ben Haggard from Regenesis. And Ben's led us through a discussion here that actually has two threads. One is the idea of community will, and the other is this notion of the kind of complexity, layering, if you will, of agriculture in our urban places or in our places where we develop. So, Ben, that's where we left off at the break. Can you say more about that?
And we want to get to how we do this, too.
Yeah, how we do this practically.
Okay. Well, an awful lot of urban space is highly simplified, and it's simplified for various reasons. We have a kind of cultural preference for lawns that has a historical basis. We will dedicate large areas of space to playing fields as exercise areas for kids and communities and so on. And so there are an awful lot of those spaces that need to actually be transformed in terms of how we view them and how we use them if we are to achieve this level of productivity.
For example?
Well, for example, one of my favorite things, there was a bumper sticker campaign in Santa Fe some years ago with, you know, people had on the back of their cars saying, "Our kids need more soccer fields." And I thought, why in the world do our kids need more soccer fields? Our kids need to be out in this natural system. The last thing we need is to be pouring water, which is such a scarce resource here, on the ground to create grass that doesn't grow here so kids can play soccer.
And there's nothing biophilic about that.
No, it's just nuts. It's like totally, it's imposing something onto this landscape in this place that continues to separate us from it.
Just like golf courses.
Yeah. And you know, golf courses are great where you've got sheep-grazed grass, but why in the world introduce them to Phoenix?
Okay, so what's the alternative?
So, in a way, the alternative is cultural. How do you reignite a love for, a passion for what this place offers as an opportunity to live actively with it and to raise children who garden and run and, hunt and, engage with this landscape on the terms that it dictates?
So in practice, how might one go about doing that?
Well, I would, in practice, again, this goes, the starting point comes to community will, that we are a community that aspires to be that, to live in harmony with this place.
Fair enough.
Find out how this place works and what it means to contribute to it, right, rather than detract from or subtract from its well-being and health. And so...
And that means they have to understand it.
Yeah. So that's the starting point, is understanding it and reigniting or lifting up the caring that people have for it. That, until you've done that, proposing to rip up, sod at parks isn't going to get anywhere. Right?
You probably have rocks thrown at you.
Yeah. And it's interesting. I was working with an Outward Bound-based experiential learning school at one point, a charter school. And they were putting themselves out in a remote place in the landscape, and so the landscape provided extraordinary opportunities for kids engaging with that landscape. But this particular group was really focused on wanting to train the kids in kayaking. Right? Now, mind you, this is in a place where there is no water proximate to the school. So they were going to have to build swimming pools in which kids could learn how to kayak, right? Whereas right outside their door, there were all kinds of rabbits to chase. You get what I mean?
Yeah, I see the imposition, yeah.
So, it's the same with the oak tree example. You know, you live in California, you're surrounded by oak trees, and everybody's trying to grow something, that instead of allowing the landscape to dictate to us, we always are trying to dictate to it.
Right, so we mow down thousands of acres and plant corn or soybeans.
Precisely.
And that brings up something, too, is that it's the relationship between plants that actually allow them to thrive. And I know you've said this indirectly today, Ben, maybe even directly, but I think it needs to be reinforced, is that polycultural farming is much more productive than monocultural farming. Can you say something about that?
Well, it has to do with a number of things. One is that when you have a polycultural system, your disease and pest resistance tends to be built right into the system.
And resilience,
yeah. I mean, you're actually holding more moisture and organic material in the soil. You're creating habitat for your beneficial insects and so on. This is one of the things that vintners are starting to learn in California. If you actually create insectaries into the vineyard, it's more than just organic practice. It's actually building in a natural system that supports the health of the plants you're trying to grow.
Wow. So in terms of systemic issues, maybe it's obvious, but I think it's worth identifying that when you do begin to integrate your built environments with your food production, all the energy and emissions associated with transporting that food can go away.
Right. That's one of the big drivers in the whole locavore movement. I mean, the whole locavore thing is, one, about better quality food because it's fresh and local.
Mm-hmm.
Participating in that kind of exchange with the place that you live that you were describing, as well as reducing the carbon footprint of food production.
And what's interesting, when you bring the food locally, you're also creating more will.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that, and I don't know if we mentioned this. John, remind me if I've already said this. I was at a conference where Andre Stuani was speaking this week, and he was talking about how new urbanists, this is the guy that basically is in love with urban form, but he's and his movement and the movement of new urbanism are actively introducing urban agriculture as an integral component to urbanism.
Yeah, you said that on the last show.
Okay.
That's okay. It bears repeating.
Good.
The pattern that I keep seeing here, and let's see, guys, this is, I think, our episode number 10. In virtually every episode, the same theme keeps emerging, and I think we finally captured it in the last one. But Ben, everything you've been saying here leads back to it, and that is that we can't create new potential in the world without creating new potential in ourselves. That's what this new community will is that you're talking about, right?
Yeah, there's work that is done on ourselves, and then there's work done with the community. Because what I think one of the failures of some of the sustainability stuff that's come out so far is it's built so much around American self-independence and self-reliance that it tends to focus on what the individual can do. But this kind of work becomes so much more leveraged when it becomes collective, when it becomes at the neighborhood or community or regional level.
And that gets us into back, if you will, right back to the whole idea of integration.
Which is a great place to say goodbye to Ben. And Ben, we thank you very much for this,
John.
Really beautiful discussion today. And Bill?
Thank you, Ben.
Thank you.
And so this idea of whole comes, we're right back to it again. How could we keep coming back to it? Hard to avoid.
So where do we go, Bill?
Well, we're going into then look at how do we see holes.
In patterns?
Well, how do we, patterns are how you hold complexities. And by the way, a story, we've talked about that a lot, a story is a way to hold patterns.
And Ben was just talking about that too when he was talking about, look, it's not that there's one agricultural practice, it's a complex system of multi-levels of agriculture as well as developmental practice.
Right, and this is why, I mean, we keep building it and turning and going around and around, but you can't just go at this head on with one piece and say, here, you got the answer. It requires all these different dimensions. And this is why this work in green building is actually not as easy as buying a PV panel or a photovoltaic panel or using low-flow toilets. It is about looking at all these different dimensions of life and entwining them into a whole system, which requires a time and an iterative process.
Yeah, so it's not about products and technologies. Yep, we need them.
We need them. It is about that, but it's insufficient. And so we're going to be talking about how we recognize patterns, and we're going to be talking after that with Carol Sanford about how this actually works not only for buildings, but in the organizations that are within buildings.
So next week we'll be having a great chat with permaculturalist Joel Glansberg.
Right.
And once again, we learned today, I think, that to do different things, we need to do things differently.
And to do things differently, we need to think about them differently.
And to think about them differently, we need to be different, yes? So thanks, everyone. So long. See you next week.
Bye.
Thank you for tuning in this week to Building Deeper Green, Reframing Sustainability with Bill Reed and John Becker. Please join us again next Friday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Green Talk Network, and make it a great and greener weekend.